transporter accident.
The beam was redirected through time, not space.
Redirected where?
Not where. When?
Sends the crew 3 centuries back in time.
This is not the Earth we're used to, Doctor.
Into the heart of a full-scale revolution.
This place is about to explode.
But getting home may mean rewriting history.
That's enough!
On the next Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Transfer complete.
Hello, and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton getting his tribal Maori tattoos in the 1990s.
And we have a very special guest beaming over from the Defiant, Mr. Andy Chan.
All right, glad to be here again.
Yes, very exciting. Last time you were here with us to talk about, what was it? It was Gambit, right?
It might have been Gambit.
Right.
One of my favorite two-parter episodes.
That's right.
Star Trek. Wow. Okay. Oh, Cam, what is our conundrum this week?
This is a flashback to a DS9 classic, past tense.
Classic, you say?
Well, depending who you ask.
Okay, well, of course, for those who don't recall, I would urge you to watch this episode before listening to the podcast, but this is the DS9 two-parter in which Jadzia, Julian, and Ben Sisko, they transport back in time to 2024 in San Francisco when it's not looking all that great.
What are you talking about? I thought this was a utopian vision of 2024.
Don't be such a dim, Cam.
This is as good as it gets after the Trump presidency.
Okay, well, you bring that up, and I think we can dive into a lot of the social themes going on and the political themes that I think maybe...
Feel very timely.
Well, I'm the word that I kept writing down throughout this review as I was taking notes was relevance. Mm. You know, so I'm intrigued by this episode because my memories of the episode are actually kind of different than what we had just watched. And so it was a very fascinating kind of exercise doing this because, Cam, you and I discussed this. We weren't really looking forward to rewatching this two-parter that much, were we?
I think this was pretty much at the bottom of my list of two-parters I wanted to rewatch for this podcast.
Yes. Andy, what were your initial memories of past tense? Do you have any when the first time you went through and watched Deep Space Nine?
I have no... Actually, that's not true. I did have a memory of the final scene where you see Sisko's face. That's my only memory of the two-parter.
As Gabriel Bell, yes. Or Gabe, as his friends call him, for apparently no reason.
Mr. Bell to the rest of you.
Yes. Cam, what about your first memories?
I have vague memories of watching it, and I recalled a lot of the hostage crisis situation stuff, and bits and pieces of Bashir and Sisko walking around sort of the torn-up streets. But I don't... I just remember watching it, and... I don't know if I even hated it. I think I just was like, well, this isn't as... It didn't grab me the way that some of the other DS9 episodes were around that point in time.
It felt less substantial.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is the season, season 3, which opens with The Search, part 1 and 2, which are fantastic and really open it up to the Dominion War and all that. And so an episode like this, which I actually think is helped a bit by watching it just isolated on its own, at the time was like, I don't care about the Gabriel Bell riots. I want to know about the Dominion.
And I'll say one thing about this, though, is I think this is less of a character-based show than more of a kind of classic issues-based Star Trek show, which is something that I think fit in more with, say, the original series. But it is a little jarring as you're going through Deep Space Nine, which is so heavy on the character stuff. And this was not... So much. I don't know. Andy, would you call this... Who's this story about? Like, if you had to pick, like, one of the main characters, who's it about, essentially?
I would say it's probably about Ben Sisko.
Yeah.
Just because it's trying to show him as kind of, like, fighting for justice. That kind of strong, moral center kind of character.
Whereas a lot of the other Ben Sisko heavy episodes are more about kind of his own internal conflict or trying to grapple with his identity as the emissary, what have you. My first memories of this, I actually watched this first run. I was always tuning in for a two-parter no matter what. I wasn't watching DS9 super consistently at the time. I remember watching it as a kid, and I do remember, like, chuckling at a couple things, like how people are all getting, you know, tribal tattoos in the 1990s in high school because it's the cool thing to do.
Well, you got one, right?
obviously. But yeah. I had to get rid of it if I wanted to get a job.
You got the face one, though, and that was a little unfortunate.
Yeah. So, I mean, at the time, even as a kid, I remember thinking, like, it's not nearly as an exciting of a two-parter as I typically hope for.
Right, yeah. Like, how old were you when you watched this episode?
This, I would have been 11, I believe.
There's no way this episode would have appealed to most 11-year-olds.
I don't believe I've seen this episode since I was 11 because I don't have... I remember so much of it just going over my head as I rewatched it now this time, you know? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So let's dive into it. Andy, your first reaction, it's been some years since the first time you watched it, but what's your reaction viewing it nowadays? How does compare with Gambit?
Well, I was going to say that this is really disappointing for me to see. I just think that it tried to kind of be one of those moral fable kind of episodes, but it really felt flat for me.
Okay.
And I mean, can't compare to Gambit, you know, where
what
I
can think, really.
Yeah. You know, Gambit's trying to be like that swashbuckling adventure.
Yeah.
And I think that in that goal it achieves it.
Yeah, where a lot of pottery gets, you know, tossed around.
Yes.
Yeah. Cam, your reaction just watching it now?
I enjoyed it a lot more this time.
Yeah.
I found the first half more intriguing. I like the way they kind of build the world of 2024, alternate 2024. And I just became more engrossed in the story going like, I don't remember this. Like, I don't remember feeling as involved. And then you can tell they ran out of money after the part one. And part two, I think, kind of drops the ball a bit. You know, it never feels like there's really any tension of a police standoff, which, you know, if you're going to do a Dog Day Afternoon in Star Trek, that you kind of need that tension.
Attica.
Yeah.
Attica.
This didn't seem like it needed to be a two-parter episode to me.
Okay, that's always the thing that we're questioning whenever we watch these two-parters. Can it justify itself, this double-length episode? So mm-hmm. Let's dive into that a little later on. I think for myself, this was... viewing this episode has helped a lot by recently... People are celebrating the 10-year anniversary of Children of Men just over the past month. It was released end of December 2006. And so I went back and I've been reading, you know, essays online, and I rewatched it just a few weeks ago. And just some of the themes that you kind of shrugged off, you know, back in 2006 seem so much more relevant right now. And I think this episode seems so much more relevant now these days, just all the social injustices going on, than I ever imagined it when Cam, you and I were just lamenting about, oh, we're going to have to watch Past Tense.
Right.
Nothing episode that was. Andy, I don't agree with you, sir.
That's good.
I know you're saying this is more of a kind of one of those moral stories, but I think at least part one, it succeeds in what Cam was saying, that world building. And it kind of, I think the story that they're trying to tell here seems far more relevant now than maybe when it was released 22 years ago at this point.
This two-parter actually reminded me a lot of Harlan Ellison's original version of City on the Edge of Forever, which was far grittier and grimier and much more about people who were very destitute and broken. Like the version, you know, we would see on Star Trek, the original series, was much more of a little bit of an idyllic look at maybe the Depression, whereas Ellison's was not.
Yeah.
And
almost a romanticized version of the Depression. A
little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas to me, like, this is more of like that Ellison kind of vision where it's ugly, it's dirty, it's unpleasant, and there's like a real undercurrent of violence to it, which I kind of appreciated.
We've got the dims, the gimmies, the ghosts.
Yeah.
Cam, what did you think of BC, the main ghost?
Well, I always love when I see, especially in the sort of 80s, 90s, when they would show depictions of, like, street toughs.
Yeah.
And, like, I was just waiting for a scene of these guys gathered around, like, a flaming garbage can being like, take me back, do-do-do-do, take me back.
Yeah, Seth. Well, I mean, Andy, if you were, you know, just walking around in your day-to-day life and some guy came up to you and started calling you new boy, hey, new boy, as BC did to one Benjamin Sisko, what would your reaction be?
I guess it would feel very threatening. It's like just any other kind of slur, like whether it's a racial slur or if it's based on your, you know, economic status,
yeah,
or your newness to a community. Like it's very like it's like a violent. It's an act of violence.
New boy, act of violence, says Andy Chan.
Yes.
Okay. Well, okay. obviously, Andy, you did not feel that this was so successful when it comes to the kind of the depiction of the social injustices here. But Cam, what are your thoughts on this?
I do think it is fairly a well done portrait of sort of bureaucracy just really just churning people up.
Yeah.
And completely, you know, not giving people any sort of hope, locking them away.
And just for those who may not recall, I mean, of course, this episode, it's centered on the fact that Julian and Ben Sisko, they're tossed into this sanctuary district, about 20 square blocks where about 10,000 people are living. And these are people that are out of work. They're looking for jobs, but they have no opportunities to find jobs in these government-mandated sanctuaries. And they just become destitute. And it's really about how you treat the people that are most vulnerable in society. And this is dealing with like mental health issues. Of course, we have Clint Howard appearing in part two. I don't know if that's the best depiction of somebody facing mental health problems.
I think there's better ones early on, just in sort of brief sketches of characters. Yeah. I actually thought it was interesting initially when they're walking through the area. Sisko is kind of pointing at these homeless people saying, you know, these people are, you know, normal people, or they just don't have jobs. And I was like, ooh, that's a real like naive look at the homeless. And then I would appreciate when we then saw shortly after depictions of the people who were psychologically not well off.
Yes.
I was interested, though, that they never raised any sort of allusions to substance abuse.
Yeah, you know, that's a very good point that I guess I totally missed. Because I hear the three of us, we all live in Vancouver, where there is like a very big homeless problem.
Yeah.
That I think the vast majority of it can be traced back to substance abuse issues. And, you know, so it's something that we're very familiar with. Whereas this was, I guess, more focused. Do you think it could have just been opening up a whole other can of worms, a whole nother conversation for an entirely different episode? Like, do you think they just, it was smart of them to keep this more narrowly focused?
Probably.
Yeah.
I think once you start involving things like substance addiction, it becomes a lot darker. And I don't know if there would have been issues with like the broadcast standards being like, look, Star Trek's a family show.
Yeah.
We can't have people fixing, you know, on, because the character of BC, you could easily write as a drug addict.
Yeah, I could see that. What do you think, you know, Andy, about just the depiction of the sanctuary? You know, if this depiction of social injustice was not so successful in your eyes, what do you think about just maybe the aesthetics or, you know, how they created this kind of world throughout this two-parter?
Well, I actually have a few notes on, I liked how they kind of dropped in little nuggets of what the bigger picture of the world was. Like, they had the helicopter surveillance constantly mm-hmm. going through.
They got their budget cut. They couldn't use actual helicopter. Yeah, we just no. saw the lights.
Spotlight. Yeah.
It was a grip up there with a flashlight.
It's mentioning, like, reference to the interface operating license. So that's it's control over media.
Yep.
That you need a, it's not like free access to the net. You need a license. Everybody's got fingerprint IDs that are required in order to get basic services, you know, access to food and water.
This is only 7 years away. Does any of this seem just like out of this world at this point?
In terms of technology?
Yeah.
Not
I
really.
Think it's all within kind of the realm of possibility as it was depicted here, which is interesting because, you know, whenever you see depictions of the future, especially the not so distant future, you usually kind of roll your eyes. I'm looking at you, Back to the Future Part Two. But I mean, aside from those gigantic desktop computers that everyone uses, you know, there's a lot of stuff here.
Wait, weren't we recording the podcast with one of those not too long ago? No,
don't get me started, Cam. But yeah, I all the stuff that you're touching upon, Andy, it's cool to me, and because I think it all seems, like I said before, like relevant to, you know, nowadays and something that could be implemented. I just think the world right now seems like a far scarier place than when I watched this episode for the first time in 1995.
Well, it's also now that you're older. I mean, you can see these kind of things. Was when you're 11, well, when I was watching Star Trek when I was 11, all I cared about was the battle scenes.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Now I go back and watch those episodes about, like, you know, is Data a human, or, you know, those are the interesting ones.
Oh, I thought you were going to say now all you care about are the love scenes, but no. Okay.
Leah Brahms.
Oh, dear. What about you, Cam? Like the world building aspect of this? You brought it up before.
Yeah, like to me, my memories of this episode were not that it had strong world building.
Yeah, I know.
Whereas, like, I really appreciated watching it because when we started it, I really thought it was going to be, you know, them locked up in the office with the hostages within like the first, you know, like 25, 30 minutes or something.
Yeah.
And they really took their time just walking around, you know, the slums essentially, setting up sort of the different types of groups that are the factions that are at work, the sort of geography, the environment, the way the bureaucracy works. I thought that was really well handled.
It's fascinating to me how Ira Steven Behr obviously wanted to tackle these social issues so head on. The other thing that DS9 doesn't usually do to this degree, though, is tackle technobabble so head on. How do you guys think they fared when it comes to just like gargling out technobabble through a lot of this? Poor O'Brien and Kira, is all I have to say.
Well, I can say they were consistent. Like,
consistently like, confusing.
Well, talking about the angular confinement beam and yes. the chronotron particles and yes, temporal sir. Energy, I mean, those terms happen. Well, they pop out a lot in anytime there's like a transporter accident.
Also, subspace bubble.
Yes.
Yeah. Actually, that's what we should rename the show, Cam. Subspace bubble.
Rebranding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you guys think about Chief O'Brien's really crappy transporter console that he had here? Like, remember on like the Enterprise D, he had like this giant console that he could do anything with, and this it's what like maybe two fingers can fit on at the same time.
I noticed Odo was actually only using two of the three sliders there.
You know, you don't get luxury on DS9. No.
That's true.
Bare bones.
Just getting back to the themes you mentioned, though, I just wanted to say, like, originally, like, this episode was actually conceived as an episode about the homeless.
Yeah.
And it was going to be called Cold and Distant Stars, and it was going to be about Sisko going back in time and ending up homeless. And Robert Hewitt Wolf wrote it, and it just didn't work. No one liked this script.
Was it a one-parter? Or was that the idea at the time?
I would think so, yeah. And right. then, ultimately, you know, Ira Steven Behr, et cetera, came on and revised it, and they turned it into this two-parter. And there was a lot of inspiration from the Attica prison riots. I also have to wonder how much was influenced, too, by the Rodney King and L.A. riots instances, which would have been early 90s.
Yeah.
This is made in 95. Gabriel Bell, you know, a black man who's essentially kicks off a huge riot, Rodney King. The parallels are interesting. No reference to it, though, on Memory Alpha, which I thought, you know, I would have thought there would be a quote.
But maybe that's why I like Star Trek so much, is things can be, you know, left to interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
But I do you have to believe that this is maybe an episode that, you know, Avery Brooks was kind of salivating to do? You can kind of tell when, like, he's really into an episode.
This that's reminded true. Me a lot of the that one, the newspaper. Where they were basically...
Far Beyond the Stars?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Well, I mean, I think it had a similar themes of, like, you know, justice. And...
Well, okay, let's get into it a little bit because, you know, with Far Beyond the Stars, that was very much tackling racism. Mm-hmm. And racism wasn't really addressed, if at all, throughout this episode, which if you look at maybe the stuff that I think is so relevant going on right now, if you see kind of this populist backlash, this anti-globalization backlash that's going on, in, say, the United Kingdom with the Brexit, in the United States with the election of Donald Trump, a lot of it is a backlash against immigration, which you can tie down to xenophobia and racism as well. So, look, if only to make this episode even more relevant to me, it would have been interesting if they could have tied racism into the show somehow, but... Look, I don't know how many plates you want to be spinning when it comes to something like this.
I know Ira Steven Behr said there was subtle allusions to that, in that it was Sisko and Bashir who had the most trouble, whereas Jadzia was kind of treated like a princess.
Oh, yeah, that's a very good point. Mm. You know, what do you think, Andy? Do you like racism?
I don't really see it as... I didn't think it was really necessary to add that in, but...
I'm only thinking about it in through the prism of time and retrospect, in that I can appreciate this episode in a way, at this particular moment in history, that I just could not appreciate you know, a few decades ago when I first saw it. So that's my particular angle, though.
What one thing?
Yeah, do I get the sense from you that nothing really could have salvaged this episode for you, Andy?
Well, I'm trying to think about what I didn't like about this episode. And
seems like a whole lot.
Yeah. And I think
You're like me during our Gambit review.
the whole point of this episode was to highlight these issues of social inequity and wealth disparity and the consequences of that, then why was it necessary to have that stupid time travel element in it at all? Why couldn't it be written
like on an alien planet?
Yeah, or something. Or done like the Inner Light, you know, where it's in the mind.
Sure.
Right? There's no
more of like a veiled metaphor than an actual let's go back in time and actually experience this moment. Yeah.
Well, maybe that's just like the writer signaling, you know, how relevant it is. Like, this is something that we need to be addressing because, look, maybe, yes, the illusions say we could use like aliens as like maybe a metaphor for things. But I don't know, maybe it's even more powerful seeing that this is something going on in the not too distant future from 1995, you know, to 2024. It could be a very strong possibility.
Why do you think it is, though, they did it as a actual let's go back in time episode versus, you know, like there's like I think of the Voyager episode Critical Care, which looks at the healthcare system but uses, you know, an alien planet.
Okay, well, I think maybe you answered that question earlier. This is originally written as, you know, Ben Sisko becomes homeless.
Yeah.
How do you really depict that on an alien planet, Andy?
Well, he could be homeless on an alien planet.
Well, you drop him into the alien planet, and he's stranded, and he's ostracized because he's an alien.
Right?
That could be the racist metaphor.
Yeah.
Because this was not something DS9 did a lot of. Like, let's just go back to a real-world event and show, you know, the plight of humanity.
Yeah. Whatever you feel about Andy, like, this works for me. Like, so I'm just curious about, like, is it just the fact that it had to be depicted through time travel? What I want to get at is, what is it that really irks you about this episode that you think it's ultimately unsuccessful at what it's trying to depict?
Well, I think it's distracting to me because...
Like the time travel
Time travel element is because time travel is very difficult to do.
I've tried my best, I believe me. Yeah, I know.
Keep dropping that toaster in the bathtub. It's just not working.
And... I think that time travel stuff just kept pulling me out of the moment. Like, they used it as like, you know, comic relief, having Kira wear that nose bandage and then have the stupid transporter disappearing thing
in front of the hippies doing the V sign. Yeah.
That felt like wedged in kind of comedy relief. Yeah. I think because the actual subject of the episode is so heavy, they were like, we need something.
Something lighter for levity,
yeah.
Okay, but I mean, those are just like small moments. But like what you're saying, though, is overall this episode does not work for you. And I'm just trying to get... I'm not attacking. I'm just trying to get at the deeper issue, like why you don't think it's successful, though, at what it's depicting. Because honestly... Going into this one, like as Cam and I said before, we're not looking forward to rewatching this episode. And maybe I'm benefiting from the fact that my expectations were pretty low and you were going in with no expectations. So maybe you're at more of an even level to judge it than I am. That's all.
Maybe it's just because as soon as I kind of read the synopsis about like, and as soon as I saw Go Back in Time, I just kind of like, oh my God.
Like not this again.
All right. It really does stand out for the Star Trek Back in Time episodes, though, which were traditionally a little more fanciful or fun because, you know, Voyager just a couple years later, maybe a year later, maybe two years later.
I think it was 96 that's...
Futures End.
That came out with, Sarah Silverman.
Yeah, you know, again, a Back in Time episode that's way... It's quirky, it's goofy, it's, you know...
Ed Begley Jr. Yeah. You summed him up right there.
Yeah. And, you know, the original series, when they went back in time, they were very light episodes. So this is really a standout for Star Trek for Back in Time. Because I don't think we ever saw, maybe I'm forgetting one.
Well, Time Zero, that was also a very like a fun kind of quirky episode too.
Star Trek IV, I mean, again, the whales story, you know, is very kind of light and comedic. I guess there's like Assignment Earth, but I don't think that's even particularly it's not dark and gritty. I mean, a little more serious than some of the others.
Year of Hell, that isn't there an episode?
But I think we're thinking more of like the ones where they go back in time to Earth, you know,
like to our time,
yeah,
you know, or you know, times that we've seen in our history. And it's just interesting that this is really the standout of a sort of Earth-based time travel episode where it's really unpleasant. Mm-hmm. And the episode itself is very serious.
Well, I think part of the reason I didn't like the setting as being on Earth is because I think it just kind of beats you over the head with it. It's just too much in your face.
And I think that could be a very cogent reason as to why, you know, you don't particularly care for this one. It's because it comes off as I do think it is a little heavy-handed at times.
What?
Yeah. So
Star Trek heavy-handed?
Yeah.
I know, like, Ira Stephen Bear has said that that's a common criticism of this episode he's heard. He says he's a little disappointed by that response, but he kind of understands why people have it.
All right. Well, I mean, one of the things that I can pick apart for, if I'm going to let Andy, you know, just tear this into pieces, you know, maybe I can join in just a little bit. So essentially, you've got Gabriel Bell. He essentially has a riot in his name, and that causes the Federation to be created because we find out in the alternate timeline that without the Bell riots, there would be no Starfleet, and Alpha Centauri would have like Romulans like running it, or the people would never, humans would never venture into deep space, all because of this one riot.
Well, the riot was a necessary but not sufficient condition for the creation of Starfleet.
It is maybe that butterfly effect, you know. Although, okay, so look, this riot happens, and this goes and starts correcting all the social injustices going on in the United States.
Right.
Until World War III, where everybody gets nuked, right, Cam?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
So does this actually correct? I thought it was First Contact that really brought about all the correction to all the social injustices going on in not just the United States, but Earth as a whole.
I think one of the mistakes in this episode is that they really, really overemphasize the importance of the Gabriel Bell riots.
Yeah.
I think it would have been a smarter move to indicate it as a major moment of social change, but not to really sell it as this huge galvanizing, you know, force across America, which I think really sets it at a level that the series and the franchise as a whole never acknowledges.
Yeah, why don't we have the USS Gabriel Bell?
Yeah, Gabriel Bell is never referenced again in Star Trek at all.
No. Andy, any thoughts about Gabriel Bell? Is he your Star Trek hero?
My Star Trek hero? Well, actually, I think Sisko is one of my least favorite captains.
Ooh.
Okay. Cam and I, we've already ranked the captains. How would you rank the captains? Just off the top of your head, got to do it right now.
Picard is number one.
All right.
And then Kirk is number two.
All right. And number three?
Number three. Are we talking about, I don't know.
All the captains.
I don't know, all the rest are behind.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Off the top of my head.
It's just like amorphous blob of captains after Picard and Kirk for you.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. One of the other things I'm curious about your thoughts here, just Jadzia's storyline, when, you know, Cam, you brought it up, you know, the fact that the men of color are tossed into the sanctuary, whereas the woman with the Dutch name, which her friend Chris assumes, she gets to go to this office tower. It goes to all these like wonderful parties, you know.
They looked fun, like a fun party, huh?
Yeah.
So that's five people.
Yes.
Was that in the second half?
That was in the second half, yes.
So when the budget got cut.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
And she got to crawl through the sewers.
Yeah.
There's actually something I did like about this episode in related to Jadzia. I thought that she was written well.
Yeah.
I really liked how she showed how like quick-witted she was in talking to Chris when Chris found her.
Or as I call him, the love child of Judge Reinhold and David Bowie.
He looked to me like Bill Nye the Science Guy, but with better hair.
Oh, okay.
And she did it again with when she was talking to Mr. Howard there at the end. Like just really showing
worse hair than Chris, though.
Yeah. Really showing how she's good at, you know, really good with people, you
yes.
know?
Yes. No, yeah.
And I think that sets up, that's her character.
I like it when Jadzia comes off as incredibly competent and good at her job, because I think they do that a lot more in the early seasons, whereas, like, in the latter seasons, it's mostly just her showcase episodes are more her just having, like, personal stuff going on as opposed to, like, let's show how awesome she is as a science officer.
Well, right. Once the romance with Worf starts, a lot of their episodes kind of are tied to their relationship.
But do you think Jadzia was better served with the introduction of Worf, or did that maybe diminish her character in some way? Do you think they would have given her more to do outside of just having a relationship with, you know, this iconic character? Or do you think the fact that they were able to tie those two characters together gave her even more to do?
I will never speak out against having those two characters together, because I think it's probably the best written Star Trek, you know, relationship.
Not Keiko and Chief O'Brien?
Oh, that's second.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
How about Geordi? Geordi and Brahms.
You're into the Leah Brahms, aren't you? Maybe I need to give you a copy of Loeffler's Laws, and you can learn a little bit more about appropriate behavior with holograms, Andy.
I want to hear your guys' thoughts on Chris Brenner, this character, because it's interesting. This episode has a lot of characters named after people from the Magnificent Seven, and Chris is one of them.
Well, Chris is not so magnificent, in my opinion. It's mostly like you can tell guy finds random beautiful woman passed out on the street, and he's like, let me
damsel
help you.
In distress.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And, oh, yeah, you want to come to my parties? Oh, hey, I can get you set up in a hotel. Why is he doing this? What is his motivation, guys?
I don't know, because he comes across as so milquetoast.
Yeah.
Whereas you'd think his his intentions are a little more lecherous.
He's supposed to be more like a media baron kind of guy, isn't he? Like a...
I'm Chris Brenner. I like the blank face she gives him back.
Did he convince you that he was a media baron empire?
No, he's no Mark Zuckerberg.
Sounds like he was like talking himself up there. Yeah. Well, you know what he needs? He needs a wingman. He needs a wingman to talk him up.
A Chan man.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Invite me to those parties.
Now, I mean, this guy seems to have this big empire, but it seems like he runs it out of, like, an apartment.
Yeah.
Is this all just a game? This is how he picks up women?
Well, yeah. He's got, like, this one office, which is about half the size of my apartment.
It's like a barren office. There's no one in there. Not even a secretary.
Like, he's got a nice view, and he holds parties in his office. Who holds parties in their personal office? Does that not
like
sound
his
like
office room?
Yeah,
not like the
office tower, but like in his own personal office.
This man only has an office and nothing else in his life. How successful a media baron is he?
That's a very good point.
I mean, Jonathan Pryce in Tomorrow Never Dies like blows this guy away.
Yeah, you did bring up a very good point that he only has like two friends show up to his party.
Yeah.
I did like that party for one reason. If only that, you know, they're tackling the fact that, quote, Europe is falling apart.
Right.
They're talking about the Gaullists in France as well as the Neo-Trotskyites or Neo-Trotskyists. It's more of that world building that we get mostly in part one, but this took place in part two as well.
Right. Yeah. To me, that is not like the party scene is not one of my problems with part two.
Sure.
You know, I think it's well done. It always kind of bums me out, like with DS9 in particular, that they could just never afford to do big crowd scenes.
Yeah.
Because it makes it look small. Like there's in part one, which I was referring to when saying the budget's all in part one. You know, there's the big, you know, all the districts are full. There's like the riots and the big like gatherings, and it looks big and impressive for Star Trek.
Oh yeah.
Whereas when you get to part two, like the streets are empty. There's like four people outside. You know, it just doesn't... The world that is built so well, I think, in part one really shrinks in part two. And like that party is just further evidence of that, you know, that's five people.
Yeah. Andy, would you ever go to a party like this? You said that he needs a wingman. Would you be the one to wing that man at a party like that?
No, I was just kidding.
Oh,
I don't
think
he wants nothing to do with this guy.
Neither does Jadzia. Do you think she's just kind of using him? Like, why not? You know, like she's a space alien time traveler who needs to find her friends.
It, but she's doing it in a nice way.
Yeah, you know? I don't feel as if she's abusing him, just using him.
Does Chris Brenner get to this prominent position with such a vanilla personality? Like, you got to be a little bit ruthless, a little bit cutthroat in that sort of business.
At least Zuckerberg has some quirks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this guy is like Blandy McBlanderson. He's like the Mitt Romney of media, like magnates, essentially.
He's the Vedic Barile of the media.
Wow. Yeah. Right. So what did you guys think about okay, if we look at what other characters had to do, obviously I think this is focused on Ben Sisko, followed by Bashir, followed by Jadzia. One thing that I do recall reading from my Star Trek Deep Space Nine companion is that Sadig El-Fadil said that this is the episode where he found that Bashir really changed. Like, this is his episode where he actually grew up and became a man, and from here on out, he played him more as a serious character. What do you think is if this is kind of a turning point for the character of Dr. Bashir, Andy?
I didn't do my homework, and what I was telling Cam was I was planning to watch a couple episodes prior to this to figure out where in Deep Space Nine this fit. So yeah. I can't really remember what Bashir was like before and after this, but what I did notice, Bashir, the ways in which the Bashir character could have changed a little bit was that he, you know, insisted on doing what he thought was right, helping people, regardless of how, you know, he weighing that against his other obligations to not to not disturb the timeline.
Yeah.
And he chose to, you know, proceed with his oath to, you know, help people.
Yeah.
He also has that big monologue where he's talking about like how is society allowed to run like this, and what happens if this happens to the Federation and it all crumbles? You know, are we any different than these people?
It's the danger of apathy.
Right. And that's something that we hadn't really seen a lot of on Star Trek at this point in time. And what would make DS9 so special?
Yeah, I do think that this would be kind of a good turning point for Bashir, because you can definitely remember that he was such a real kind of immature kind of character.
I think snot-nosed, yeah.
Yeah, in the early seasons. And it's so weird just seeing how this character was very much my least favorite DS9 character when the show began, and he turned into like one of my favorite characters by the time the show ended. And I think this is interesting, kind of maybe seeing this as, you know, 2.5 years into the series, you know, the actors saying, look, I can take this guy in a different direction from here on out. This is a significant enough event, you know, time travel, no matter what Andy thinks of it. You know, so beyond, we've covered Ben, Bashir, Jadzia.
I was gonna say about Bashir though.
Yeah.
It seems like he sort of disappears a bit in the second half. Once they get in that standoff, there's a lot less for Bashir to do.
Yeah, well, because, you know, something that I was keeping track of, and you are correct, Cam, Ben Sisko very much comes even more into the forefront by part two as well. So throughout this, Cam, I was telling you that one of my few memories of this two-parter before you sat down to watch it was that it seems as if everybody just pumped shotguns the entire episode. Like, that was my strongest memory.
Yeah.
I took a tally of how many times shotguns were pumped throughout this episode. Andy, would you like to take a guess how many times a shotgun was pumped throughout this two-part episode?
10 times.
All right, Cam, any guesses?
7.
Okay, so twice in part one and 6 times in part two for a total of 8 shotgun pumps. And I think a gun was only fired twice.
That's one of those things, though. If I'm an actor and I get to hold a shotgun in a movie, I just want to, like, keep doing that every scene.
That chick sound.
Yeah, yeah. Well, of course. Yeah. Like, why wouldn't you?
Right. Well, beyond those three characters here, I mean, do you think this is essentially just a Kira O'Brien team up?
Yeah, I mean, those are two characters who didn't get put together a lot, and this is sort of an early... They would later.
Yeah, they would later. Yeah.
But at this point in time, not so much, and this was just a sort of fun, minor opportunity to have those two working together.
And speaking of which, how often do Bashir and Ben get paired together? Like, I'm just intrigued by the fact that they chose these two characters to, you know, have this adventure together. I think it makes sense because, look, you want this to be a Ben Sisko episode. Maybe it makes sense to bring the doctor with him if he's going to be stuck in a sanctuary.
It's also just the contrast of the character who's sort of the older, wiser one with the younger, more inexperienced.
Yeah, because who would is the other option have been for him to be traveling the sanctuary with? Like, maybe Jadzia, I could see that.
Vedic bro.
Yeah, I'd hope so. Yeah, I mean...
If they'd had Nog, they could have called it Nog Day Afternoon.
Wow.
I'm here all week, folks. Tip your waitress.
Okay. I like that, actually. I'm curious. Maybe we should get into this discussion now, but does it justify itself as a two-part episode? Andy, you go first, sir.
I think I've already said no.
No? Yeah. Why? But why not?
I think that the pacing is just slow, and if it's compressed, I think it can... I don't know. This is my armchair criticism, but I think it could be compressed.
Let me throw this at you. Would it have worked as just a one-part episode?
Without the time travel? I would accept...
How would you have made it work as a one-part episode? Take away the time travel?
I'll take away the time travel, and I think you can take away the hostage scenes seem to drag along.
There are a lot of them. You've got that character played by Dick Miller, who keeps causing problems, mm-hmm. and you know it's like, well, I mean, you could have maybe cut it from him causing problems three times to one or two.
Well, I'll say this though, if we look at a character like Vin, who Dick Miller played, or BC as played by Frank Military.
That's an awesome name.
It really is. That's super badass.
I wish I had that name. Welcome to Subspace Transmissions.
Mr. Military.
I'm Frank Military.
but those two characters, they could have just been such one-note kind of characters that we've seen a million times before. They kept adding nuances to both those characters. Look, we're essentially introduced to BC when he stabbed the real Gabriel Bell to death. Mm-hmm. And they give this guy, some quirks, whether he's playing with his hat, giving the hat to Michael Webb's kid. Poor Michael Webb, by the way.
I want to get to Michael Webb in a sec.
Okay.
Put a note on that one, and let's get back to him after.
Oh, but let me ask you this, though, Cam. Yeah. Does it justify itself as a two-part episode?
I think it does, yeah. I think because there's so much world building in the first half, and what I actually really appreciated the second time was just the differences between the two. The second half is all a hostage story, whereas the first half is sort of this look at urban decay.
Yeah.
And it's just, and bureaucracy. And it's two stories that feel kind of separate, but both are one overarching story.
I think it genuinely surprises me to say this, compared to what I was thinking just 2 hours ago, but I think it does justify itself as a two-part episode. I think it would have been tough to kind of compress this into one, but I will say that part one obviously much stronger than part two because, as you both have said, that hostage sequence, which lasts for 40 minutes, it drags. And I've seen it done much better in other media, so I could have excised quite a bit of that and tried to come up with a little something different throughout the second part.
Let's talk about that hostage standoff To me, that's one of the bigger problems. Going into part two, I was really sitting there going boy, this is a lot better than I remembered it being. And that hostage stuff, at a certain point, you need a ticking clock or rising tension in that sort of scene. I never felt the sort of police presence in the standoff.
Yeah.
Other than there's the chief of police or whoever she is.
Detective Preston with the SFPD as played by one Deborah Van Valkenburg.
There you go. So she pops in and has these little negotiations where Sisko and Bashir are just kind of strolling in and out of the office.
Yeah.
And when you watch a really good hostage movie Inside Man or Dog Day Afternoon, there is a real sense of danger outside. You should feel when your protagonists walk out that door, they might not make it back into safety. I never felt that at all, especially later in the episode when Bashir and Jadzia just walk out to go, go meet up with Clint Howard. It shows them on an empty street just walking along. What? Did the police just let them wander on by?
Well, the police weren't inside the sanctuary at that point.
True.
Right. And
it just feels...
But why was the sanctuary completely deserted?
I don't know.
Yeah. Why is Jadzia able to move about freely through the sewer system? I know she explained that she reprogrammed her ident card or whatever, but I'm just okay. Sure.
What, and no one else in the sanctuary is thought to do this?
Well, maybe it's technology that they could not access. I don't know. It seemed very silly. One thing that I will say, though, is you bring up the police factor here. Another reason why I think this is a very relevant episode is because over the last 15 years, we've seen this is more so true in the United States than in Canada, but we've seen this increased militarization of police forces. And if this is not like a militarized kind of police force, I don't know what is. I think they described it actually as the National Guard, which is military, obviously. But the fact that they're resorting to National Guard to defuse a police situation, because I guess they didn't really trust this Detective Preston well enough. There you go. But how many pizzas do you think she would have had to order to meet Ben's requirement of feeding the entire sanctuary?
10,000 people, was
10, it? 10,000 people, yeah.
Oh, well.
Eight slices per pizza.
Okay.
And two slices per person, so you need so one pizza can feed four people. That's, what is that, 2,500 pizzas?
About that, yeah.
That's a lot of pizzas. Yeah, well, I guess those are created a lot of jobs that some of those people in the sanctuary could have had.
How long was the standoff?
Yeah, it's hard for me to tell. I get the sense is maybe, because Ben Sisko described the Bell riots as taking place in the first week of September.
Yeah.
And I get the sense that maybe this was over the course of like 36 hours, maybe?
Because we see the scene where it starts, it's nighttime, and they're putting those benches up over the windows.
Yeah.
And then we see the day they're negotiating. When they raid the actual, you know, office and take down BC, etc.
That was at 5 a.m., 0500. That's what Preston that's said.
Right. Okay.
So it would have been over the course of two nights. Okay. So we're looking at, about a day and a half.
Okay.
36 hours.
Did you feel that passage of time?
I felt even longer than that, in fact.
And he was like, wait, it wasn't like a three-month standoff?
All right, guys. Well, anybody have any final thoughts about this episode before we wrap up?
Let's talk about Webb.
Yeah, okay.
Because, Webb is a character that I think we're supposed to be invested in because he becomes a fairly prominent part of the ultimate resolution of this storyline. This actor, Bill Smitrovich, not charismatic at all. Like, this character to me, when you compare him to BC and a lot of the other characters in this two-parter, even Dick Miller, like, he just did not pop at all to me.
But I would say that there wasn't that much on the page for him.
No, definitely not.
Unless waving a knife at Dr. Bashir in the corridors was about the peak of what he would get to do. But yeah, was I invested in this character? Did I felt more affected by the death of BC than I did of Michael Webb?
Yeah, Andy?
Well, while we were watching, the episode was nearing its end, I was thinking that what if they had written Webb as more of, they could have given him more of a role in the episode and then made him the face of the riots.
Yeah,
because then that would have made the time travel thing like relevant to the story.
But then you would have issues of this white guy
replacing a black guy
essentially. Yeah. So I don't know if we want to go down that particular.
That's out of universe.
Okay.
Yeah.
It is interesting though because they really bring Webb front and center. You know, having him speak on the screens to the negotiators.
Yeah.
And
Have been Gabriel Bell's job, in the original timeline.
Possibly.
Yeah.
And it just is interesting that, like, I feel nothing for that character when he is taken down at the end.
No.
It also seemed a little out of character that he pulled the gun.
Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't exactly although he is waving knives at people in the hall, when his wife or when his kid is sick. But
I do that in my hallway, in my apartment building.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that.
Stay away.
It does seem odd, though, because I, like, in my head, if I'm Webb and, the police are coming in through the windows, if I'm Webb, my response is not to grab a gun and point it at them. Whereas, like, if I'm BC, probably.
Yeah, no, I agree. Webb knows he's got the kids at home.
Yeah.
Does he not want to make it home?
Oh, well, that was telegraphed and he's like, give your sister a kiss for me.
Yeah, tell your mom I love you.
Yeah, yeah.
He
might as well have just been waving the flag saying I'm dead.
Yeah. There's a couple other hostages maybe we just want to touch upon before we wrap up here, but
Are you talking about the hypoglycemic?
The hypoglycemic woman. I don't know about the actress, but I think she... at least she brought something different that we don't typically see in Star Trek, but it was a little over the top, her performance. Like, Does anyone disagree?
Nope. Yeah, okay. I mean, I think in part one, she's better. Like, I really like her scenes with Sisko and Bashir where she's talking about the system and how she doesn't like it either, but she doesn't really know. Like, she's in a position where she can't change it. She's just, you know, I'm sure for her it's a job.
Well, that's one of the themes, you know.
Right.
Everybody feels that they can't do anything about
it. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, she's employed by it. And in that first half, I was sitting watching it going, like, I don't remember this character, but I really like what she's bringing to this story. And then we get to part two, and, the actress is called on to, you know, have these hysterical breakdowns. And I just don't think they're directed very well either. The second half,
Jonathan Frakes.
Yeah. The first half was by Riza Bhatia, and the second half was Jonathan Frakes. And to me, a lot of my issues with the second half are with the direction, which falls under Jonathan Frakes. Like the scene where, she's having like this meltdown, and then also a scene where BC is like holding her face up to a camera. It looks really goofy. Like, it feels like really...
It feels goofy.
Yeah, it's goofy and over the top. And not... It should... In an episode like this, I think it's important to keep it very real and grounded.
Yeah.
And then also, just talking about the direction, too, you know, the whole... The National Guard takedown at the end, to me, was...
It's 1990s television, Cam. That's what it felt like.
It felt like an episode of Hunter.
Wow. Hunter. Did you watch Hunter when you were young?
I saw an episode or two.
Yeah, I would watch. I remember it was more of an adult show. My parents wouldn't typically let me watch it. I think it was on at like 10 o'clock or something.
I don't remember who the actor was that played Hunter, but like only in that era could that man be an action star on TV.
That guy was actually a former NFLer.
Was he really?
Yeah, that's because...
From what year?
He like the 70s, because I remember he showed up on an episode of Cheers that I've been watching. He's like in season one of Cheers.
Yeah.
And I was like, I recognize that man from somewhere. So I looked him up. I was like, he's from Hunter. I was blown away. No. Andy, did you watch Hunter?
I did not watch Hunter.
Have you even heard of Hunter?
No.
Okay.
Was it broadcast in Canada?
How old are you, Andy?
36.
Okay, so you're the same age as me. You see, like, Hunter was pretty popular in the, I think, early 90s, late 80s?
I'd say late 80s, early 90s. Yeah. Yeah.
I was watching MacGyver.
Yeah. What kind of shows I was watching. It would have been shortly after that era.
Yeah.
No, I'd say it was, like, maybe before MacGyver.
Because you had, like, Renegade, you know, Hunter, Sweating Bullets, all those shows.
Yeah.
You know, all the shows that the people listening to this podcast want to hear us talk about.
Okay. One last hostage. Remember the young fellow who was also one of those sanctuary guards?
Yeah.
He pulls out a picture of his family, and they have an insert shot of his family, and that takes place in 2024. And the family looks as if they're from, like, 1982.
I was thinking the same thing. His wife's hair was huge.
Yeah, like, is that what we have to look forward to in the next 7 years?
She looked like Delta Burke.
She's designing woman. Yeah.
Now, was that the character of Grady?
I don't know.
There's a character of Grady who was supposed to be played by Iggy Pop, and they ultimately couldn't make that happen, so they cast another actor. And then Iggy Pop, of course, popped up in Magnificent Ferengi. Down the road.
I wish Iggy Pop played Chris Brenner. Like, that would have been amazing.
That would have been awesome.
Yeah.
That would have redeemed that character single-handedly.
I think so. He would have brought it, you know. Okay, guys.
He could have played Lust for Life at the party.
Yeah, he would have had no shirt on. Doing stage dives off his desk.
Cutting himself with a bottle.
All right. Andy, final thoughts on this episode before I wrap here.
This is going to be the last time I ever watch this episode.
I thought you were going to say the last time you ever come on this podcast. I honestly thought he was going to say that.
I did too. I was like, we'll be the judge of that.
Okay. Not your favorite. Obviously, this is sub-Gambit two-part territory for you.
This was like one of the worst episodes of Star Trek I've ever seen.
Okay.
Really? Yeah. Very interesting.
Did you just find it boring more than anything else?
I think that's okay. Part of it.
Which is kind of an indictment really in and of itself. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that's how I remembered it. But watching it, that's not how I felt coming away from it. I'm very surprised by my own reaction. What about you, Cam?
Yeah, I feel the same way. I enjoyed it quite a bit. I don't know that I would put it above The Search, which we reviewed last month.
I would not, no.
But to me, in my head, it was, you know, this was a steep downgrade from The Search going into it. And I walked out of it going, like, you know, that was actually pretty good. I enjoyed it. I think it had some genuine value just in its world building and messages. It's sort of a outside the box episode for Deep Space Nine,
yeah.
which, you know, I would always appreciate episodes like Far Beyond the Stars, but I never really thought of this one as a sort of a valuable, you know, alternative type of episode to DS9. And I think I will think of it as that from now on.
Oh, why do you think? Because, I mean, you watch it for the first time not that long ago. What,
yeah.
Is it just because of where the world is right now that this seems even more, you know, relevant?
I do think that's a part of it.
Yeah.
And I do think, as I said earlier, it helps. You know, when I was watching DS9 at this point in time, I was bulldozing through episodes, right? And so it was like, oh my God, Dominion War and all this sort of stuff. Oh, the Gabriel Bell riots. Like, sure. let's get this over so I can get back to, you know, Jem'Hadar stuff and
okay.
what have you. The stuff I actually think is cool.
Yeah.
Whereas watching it in isolation tonight, you know, I'm not going home to, like, burn through the next couple episodes. I didn't watch the episodes leading up to this. So it just was a really nice episode. Like, I think maybe if I had watched it, you know, in the day, you know, syndicated week to week, maybe I would have enjoyed it more at the age. Because originally I watched this episode probably at, what, like, 32, 33? Probably younger, I guess, 30. But, I think I would have appreciated it maybe more with that kind of seeing it week to week, having that breather, coming back, finishing the story and moving on versus slamming episodes, you know, like four in a night or something.
I think that makes sense. And I will chalk up my original reaction to the fact that I was just 11 when I saw it for the first time. And while I recognize like they were trying to deal with social injustice, very much like Andy, I think I was far more interested in like battle scenes when it came to Star Trek, you know, at the time. Cam, what did you like more? What do you think was a more successful two-parter, this or the Maquis? I mean, there were not nearly as many vests in this one as there were in the Maquis. But
I do have to dock it for the vests. You know, I think I would say that this was the better. That this is better than the Maquis.
I agree. Yeah,
I love all the Gul Dukat stuff in the Maquis two-parter.
Yep.
But
even his uniform that was falling apart during that one exit out of the airlock.
Sure, but I do think this story is more compelling than the plight of the Maquis.
Yeah,
at least as presented in that episode, or two-parter.
Cam, it's rare that you and I seem to be so in sync sometimes when it comes to this.
Yeah, we
stuff.
Were very lopsided on the search. Where we were like, I far preferred part two, and you far preferred part one.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Andy, I'm glad you were able to join us, even if this was a miserable evening for you.
No, the podcast part is great.
Your presence is always welcome.
Yes, and we'll have you on for a more fun episode, two-parter or something in the future. The next one won't be, you know, we won't do like social injustices in Star Trek, the podcast episode.
All right. Cam, I think next time we do a two-parter, we're going to change things up a little bit because right now we've had the opportunity to do everything chronologically based on air dates, and we want to continue doing that with two-parters based on air dates. So the next two-parter we are going to do will be in February. That will be Caretaker because, of course, that aired after this one.
Yeah.
I believe just mere days after future or past tense parts one and two aired originally. And then I believe after that, the next two-parter to air was another DS9 episode. So
we're flipping back and forth.
We're going to be going back and forth only based on air dates. So over the next, I guess, 3 years of podcasting as we do two-parters, you can look forward to going back and forth until we get to the end of DS9's run.
I look forward to celebrating my 40th birthday with a Enterprise two-parter.
Oh, well, shockwave, man.
God, that's depressing.
How'd you celebrate your 40th, Cam? Shockwave. All right.
Okay, so on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. Let us know what you think of past tense. Are you a big fan? Do you feel that there's a disparity between part one and part two, other than the crowd scenes, which I think we can all agree on? Or do you agree with Andy, where this is a little more heavy-handed than Star Trek needs to be and is too stuck in the real world? Yeah, send us those emails. Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Cam, you and I, we've discuss this.
No, really, I have no idea. What are we doing next week?
You know, this one is one I'm looking forward to. You and I are going to tackle, you know, kind of the plight of the outsider characters. We're talking about Spock, Data, Odo, Seven of Nine, T'Pol, like these kind of like characters. Everybody's supposed to be a bit of a weirdo on these space adventures, but these are the ones that obviously don't know what it means to be human. Some of them are trying to understand better. Some of them are content with who they are. I think this will be an interesting examination of some of the most popular characters in Star Trek.
Didn't I pitch this episode?
You did, yeah.
Wow. So we're doing an episode that I pitched and I didn't even know what we were doing.
Okay.
Wow.
I'm the one in charge of scheduling, sir. That's how it works now.
I'm very bright. So you can also reach us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Vin as an idiot, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N, N as in Nogday afternoon.
And you can find me at Sockbot, S-O-C-K-B-O-T.
Nice. So until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.